I was born and raised here, right where we live today, out on the Timber Road. But I later, Dad sold the farm and we moved up to Plankton, and from there back to Vermilion. And about 19 years old, I guess, I went to California because you couldn't make a living here. And was there about a year and a half, and I come back here and joined the Navy in Yankton. I joined it for 6 years, and I found out, my buddy and I did together, and I found out he'd done it for 6 years, and I said, hey, I don't want 6 years, but I'll go for 4 years or duration. When I went up to get sworn in Sioux Falls, he said, well, you could change that at the training station. And of course, you know, that was the first lie he told that day, I think. No, I signed up for 6 years instead, yeah. Then I went from there to out of Great Lakes training camp to the OGU in Chicago, and from there went to New York. And I got on board this tanker, and I looked at that a minute, and I wanted to turn around and run because we were hauling 100 octane gasoline. And I made two trips to England with that. And last time over, we lost 20 ships in 4 nights from a German submarine. And that was a pretty damn dangerous situation. When we come back from that, then we loaded up and took another load over to North Africa and the Mediterranean. And was in there making shuttle runs from Oran on in about 6 months. And there were six of us tankers doing that, and we were the only one that came home. And from there, I went to special school and went on board this new destroyer, the Brush, as a plank owner. I put her in commission new, and I spent 30 months in the South Pacific on her, on various operations. And I guess came back after the war into Seattle, and I still had about 7 months to do to hit, so I had to go back to China. Went back to Tsingtao in Shanghai, China, in that area, and made a trip to Korea too. And from there, then I flew back to the country, to the San Francisco, and went home on leave, and came back, and I said I could get discharged, which I did. That's about the long and short of it, I guess.
When Pearl Harbor was attacked,
yeah.
and the U.S. went to war, declared the next day, of course, by President Roosevelt. Do you remember where you were and what you were doing and how you found out that the Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yes. I was driving a truck out there on a big grain field out in California, and my buddy was too, and we hung in there for maybe half a year or so, and he said that the draft caught him. So I said, well, we'll just drive back here to South Dakota and join the Navy, which we did in about June or July of 42.
Why the Navy?
Well, I guess I liked the Navy for the ship and things, but there was another reason too. I didn't want to get crawling around in a foxhole and stuff, but what I did was ever been as dangerous. But that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm. And were you placed in some really scary situations while you were doing your duty in the Navy? And would you like to talk about a couple of those?
Well, yes. The first action really we got in was over North Africa in the Mediterranean. We had a big air raid that had our 20 millimeters and stuff. But of course, on a tanker, we had guns that were obsolete from World War One. But then after that, I went out in the Pacific. The first island we hit out there was Palau, and we bombarded that. From there, we went through all the islands. I have a star for a North African campaign, and a European, and five in the Pacific battle star. I don't know. Like a dummy, I did forget that. Well, it's okay.
How did you earn those?
Pardon me?
How did you earn those accolades?
Shooting. Well, yeah, we fired bombardment on the islands and Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and well, all the islands. I think there's five different islands out there. Then, and Okinawa was we had a typhoon come through there, and they let us go out supposedly to go through the middle of the typhoon. Well, at the outer fringes. Well, of course, what they did was send us out and went through the middle of it, and we lost three destroyers capsized in it. So you can figure out how that was. It was 128-mile-an-hour wind, or knots, I guess, and it done more damage to the fleet, I guess, than the Japs did, because we had to go back to the Philippines then, and was in there for 6 weeks, a month and a half, 2 months, repair on all the ships that was in the fleet. Mm-hmm. Then we did, before that, I guess we went into, we actually went into Tokyo Bay with nine of us destroyers and did a strike against the Japanese there. And we, out of my guns, we fired 140-some rounds of 5-inch ammunition, and the other 2 mounts did whatever they could do. And we've sunk, I think, 3 ships in the process, and then bombarded the land too. When we were leaving, the destroyer rudder stuck on it, and well, they had a heck of a time getting the thing fixed, unstuck, I guess is the word I'd use. But then by this time, none of the rest of the destroyers were way out of sight, and we could see the home island of Japan. Well, they got the old destroyer kicked loose and fast as go, which was about 39 knots at 45 miles an hour, and we sailed out of there to beat hell. Yeah.
That's quite a speed for one of those ships, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. For 2,250 tons, that's what the destroyer weighed, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'd like you to tell me about the ship and describe that as best you can, some of the features that were on that ship and some of the things you remember.
Okay. The ship itself had much better gun directions than that tanker. We had none, but on this we have ICU and they can spot and actually direct the guns, the 5-inch guns at the targets, which they did, and we local fired them too. But and then, of course, it was capable of maneuvering, like, unbelievable. And then, too, of course, the old girl had enough strength to kick the plates off the rudder. So we were running around out there about half the time without any plates on the rudder, so still able to maneuver pretty good. But we did have to go in dry dock a couple of times and have new ones welded on. So, yeah, that's... I guess going back to the tanker, I did make overnight Liberty there in Bristol, England. Then the other one is from the Philippines, overnight there after the wars,
Mm-hmm. So what would you do on the overnight Liberties?
Well, in the morning we sleep mostly. Well, over in England, yes, I actually... had a girlfriend over there. We corresponded for probably a year and a half or afterwards, but that all blew up, I guess. I guess there was no problem with it, but she was on the anti-aircraft and NATS, English man anti-aircraft gun. So she was in it too, yeah.
How did you meet her?
I think on the street. Then we did go to a movie, and we were walking through the park, and I don't know, I spit on, she said, bloody bloke spitting in the King's Park, and I said, oh, I didn't realize that. So that was a little little funny to me, but it wasn't her.
Okay. The gun that you had worked, and it took 11 men inside there. Can you tell me a little bit about the roles of some of the men and why it took 11 to run that?
Yeah, sure. I was the turret captain, in which I had a pedestal up on the back of the gun, so it was up off the deck about 4 feet or more. I could sit on that and direct, or I could open the hatch on the top of the turret and locally direct the fire from there. Well, then we had our trainer, which was training the guns around, and the pointer actually pointed the guns. We actually done some damage, bombarded some used ships and stuff, and I hit it 9 times out of 10, I think it was. Well, local control. So I thought that was pretty good, and I guess they all did, I don't know. But then we had the projectileman. I did that too earlier, and that picked the projectile out of the hoist. After the powder man, he put the powder in a brass powder case about 3 foot or long, and he'd lay that in a cradle, and I'd lay the projectile in there and pull up and ram the charge with it all done hydraulic, rammed it in the gun, and if it was on automatic fire, it automatically go off right there. Then after firing in Tokyo Bay, then we fired so many rounds that the old gun got pretty hot, and one of them powder cases stuck in the barrel. So we had a little trouble getting that out of there and throw it over the side before the damn thing blew up. Or we figured it would anyway, yeah. So anyway, then we had a pointer, a trainer, a fuse setter, and the fuse setter was, he would set the fuses on a common anti-aircraft gun shells that was had fuse settings on them. And when he'd set the set, it automatically would set it to that. But then later, we got what they call Buck Rogers shells, which had plastic nose on them. And when we fired them, they were the closest they came to any target, they would blow up. So that was quite an improvement over the other shells, too. And then we had some armor-piercing shells, which we didn't use too much of that because didn't have much value to it unless it was another ship. Yeah.
What kind of range did this have?
Well, I think it was about 8 or 9 miles, I guess. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Then the battleships, when we were bombarding Okinawa, this particular anyway, the battleships would be sitting off about 6 or 8 miles, maybe 10, I don't know. And you could hear them old shells go over the top of us. Now, you could actually just catch a glimpse of them bullets, believe it or not. Projectile. And I think they weighed over a ton, them shells out of them 16-inch guns.
And in total, how many men would serve on a ship like the Brush?
On the ship I was on?
Yeah.
About 380. Yeah. Yeah. We had a good crew. Then we did we did picket duty. That's another thing, was a lot of hell and dangers too, of course. We'd go out and get between the task force and the target island or whatever they were striking with the aircraft. So when the aircraft came back, they didn't know where the task force was. They had to come by us, and we'd give them the directions to where they were. See, of course, in so doing, then the Japanese would follow them back once in a while, too, and we'd get in a hell of a lot of trouble with that. Yeah. And we did that with the 3rd and the 5th Fleet, Halsey and Mitcher, yeah.
Now, could you do any anti-aircraft that the Japanese were flying over? I mean, could you reasonably expect that you'd be able to shoot their planes down with what you had?
Yeah, yes, we could.
Okay.
One time we were, the Japanese, they did some suicide, a lot of that, on the aircraft carriers, and they come at us there one day, and we was throwing everything we had at him except the sink, I guess you might say. And I guess we threw enough stuff off him. He veered off and hit the ship beside us instead of us. Yeah.
Had to feel pretty fortunate and scared at the same
Oh,
time, I would think.
yeah, we were.
Okay.
That was the USS Blue 744, and we were the 745, the USS Brush. And there was nine of us destroyers in this squadron, and we were all capable of doing whatever we had to do to fight back. We went down through the down to the Panama, and we escorted the Hancock carrier, and one of her. They lost a man overboard, and we looked for it and never did find him. But then we went through the canal and stopped there in Balboa, and this little boy, he was bashful as hell, and we kind of got one of the girls tangled up with him a little bit, and he said, oh, he wouldn't go for that. So, but I'll tell you something else about that guy. That
all right.
The fellow overboard, when, after the war was over and up in Seattle, and I... made a date with this woman, see?
Now, is this the English woman or someone else?
No, different woman.
Okay.
This is a native of Seattle. She had a little farm, and believe it or not, she told me that her husband had fell overboard off the Hancock. You believe that or not? Yeah, I told her, well, hey, I was there and helped look for him. Yeah.
That's an amazing coincidence.
Yes, it is.
And they never did find him, correct?
No, they never did. No, we used, well, another thing too out there in the Pacific, when the planes come in after striking, a lot of times they're bunged up so bad that they wouldn't let them land on a carrier. So then they'd pancake in the water and we'd rescue them. And we were rescued almost all of them. It was a few that we couldn't, but we did the best we could there too. And we'd send guys overboard to help them on board ship. And one guy that was in a rubber raft out there for how long, I don't know, but we had to bring him on board, and he was pretty badly decomposed. And two of the boys jumped in to tie ropes around her, and that was awful. Sharks all over the place, too, you know. And they brought him on board and recognized who he was through his tags, I guess. And they sewed him up in canvas and put him alongside of my gun turret, and that arrow blew up through there, and man, he was there with us for over a year afterwards, smell him. Then we took him over there and on a trough and buried him at sea. Had a burial at sea, So that was, I guess, was a good thing in a way we found him, because at least his family knew what happened to him. Mm-hmm. When I went on the tanker, you know, I told you, well, when I looked at that darn thing, I wanted to turn around and run. I got to, if it has to be, it does, I guess.
And were you assigned to this particular tanker in this assignment?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So I'd like you to talk to me a little bit about the refueling process and how that worked. I know you showed me a photo and how you're able to refuel the ships. How was that done?
Well, there again, I'm a line-throwing champion on the ship. And, yeah, I was. And if we were close enough, I could... throw a line across with a lead weight in it, a monkey fist, they call it. But if it was too far away, then I had to use a 45-70 caliber gun and with a brass projectile and shoot across to the ship, whichever we're going to refuel off of. And they in turn would bring another line across. Finally, they would bring the refueling line over, and then we would go ahead and refuel. But refueling itself was a dangerous thing, and we were refueling alongside a carrier one time out there, and the admiral was on board the carrier, and he hollered over and told the captain, he says, hey, you know, captain, you guys are leaving a pretty crooked wake back there. Captain hollered back, well, we're just following you guys. He didn't make no points on that.
I can imagine he didn't. Mm-hmm. Okay. Were there some anxious moments in refueling? I know you said that you were a little apprehensive about having to do that. What are some of the stories you remember that might have been a little dicey?
This one boy that got killed is in my crew. We'd get out and go out there when the ship would dive in it, then you'd have to get in through this hatch. And dog got down to get away from it. See, well, he didn't make it, but we did. And that's just one of the instances, yeah.
And Was it fairly easy, of course, having all that fuel in there and as dangerous as it was it fairly easy for one of those to explode from some sort of combustion or?
Oh, yeah, it could, sure. Then we had a lot of depth charges too, and we'd shoot them off the side with a K gun. They shoot them off with a shell, and the other one, bigger one, the 500 pounders, they'd go off the fantail. We'd dump them off on the submarines. I guess we did sink some of them. I don't know for sure, but I think we did, yes.
You had mentioned one experience, and that was involving a monkey on the ship. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened there?
Well, yeah, over in the Philippines, after we could go in there, of course, by then the little junk boats, they used to call them, they did the same thing over in China too. Some of them just live and die on them little boats, see, and they come up alongside and try to sell us some darn thing or another. And so this is how we got a hold of that monkey. And of course, they had fooled around with the monkey in there quite a while, had quite a time with him, I guess, but he'd get into more mischief anyway. Actually, he'd bite too, of course. And then when I had my gun locked apart and had to clean them because they had to fire, be able to fire them without any shorts in them, see, so electrically. And so I had it laying on the deck there, and then the monkey got a hold of that one and he threw it over the side. And fortunately, we had some spares because we didn't have any real bad problem, but could have, yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did happen to the monkey eventually?
Well, I think he landed, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I'm not sure they might have threw him back on a boat. But and also we were in Tsingtao, China, and Shanghai, China too. See, and then boats had come on board alongside of us there. We were anchored in the Huanggu River there, in Shanghai. And they'd come on by there and try to sell us everything from soup to nuts, of course. And then it was not unusual to see a dead body come floating by us almost every day. And the Chinese there was a little cantankerous. We went up to the Nanking Road on one of them jinrikishas. I got a picture of that somewhere. But anyway, sometimes they'd throw them shafts over their head and dump you out on the floor ground, and then they'd rob you. Well, we'd bring charges against them. Of course, they'd bring a bunch of Chinese on board and blow our charges all to hell, of course. And so yeah, we got some. I think some of the guys got some real bad time over that, and maybe discharge. I could never understand that, but that's the way it was.
So that never happened to you when you were in one of the boats?
No, it never did. No.
And where were you when you found out the war was over?
We were laying off in Japan. I'll tell you what, we were laying off there, and when they dumped that bomb, see? And we knew when they did it, I guess we could actually feel the waves from it. And then the captain, a little short time later, then a few days later than that, well, then captain come on board and said, well, they had given up and would sign an armistice, and so they were going to go into Tokyo Bay and do this, and we went in there too. I had a picture of that. I don't know where it happened, but anyway, yeah, we went in there with it, and we were anchored in there in Yokosuka Naval Base, and then you could see the old two-man submarines still laying around on the deck in there that they used against us on different occasions too. Yeah. But they had a naval base there that was unbelievable for equipment and stuff they had. They had some good ships too. Yeah.
Did you kind of have a feeling in the days leading up to the surrender that it was going to be happening?
Well, yeah, we were laying off. Yeah, I guess I get it. We were up there off there, and we laid around it for 87 days without seeing land, and we knew that something was going to happen. And then we were laying there kind of chewing our fingernails, if you want to call it that, I guess, and figuring out what was, you know. And of course, then sometime later, I guess the captain come on board and said, well, I had given up. And so then they got the torpedo alcohol, which you probably didn't hear about that, but they used to, some of the guys used to drink that. I never did, because that 190 proof. So they put a bunch of that in a big coffee pot, about a 15-gallon coffee pot, I guess.
Was there a particular recipe for this then? Or?
I think he made it up.
Oh.
They put some grapefruit juice, I guess, and stuff like that in there with it, and we drank a toast to them, to the surrender. Yeah.
Okay. And then how soon after the surrender were you back in the U.S.?
They surrendered probably six, eight months, I think, yeah.
So about the time of your discharge?
Oh, yeah. Another thing, too, on that heavy seas in that destroyer, we had to go down to eat down the mess hall, and that was one of the slippery mess because I never got sick, but everybody else did, I think. You slide from one end to the other, and we'd have to go down there in between general quarters. That's another thing, too, you know, that we had to stand general quarters on guns. They'd let one crew go at a time, and so that's how that worked. Yeah. And the old captain on there, he was quite a character. He was ornery and held, and he gave extra duty to guys for no reason at all, but I jumped him after the war was over at one of the reunions. I said, you know, you're pretty damn mean. He said, well, you know, I had a whole bunch of boys on that ship. He says, I was determined to bring them home. This is something I could never understand. I flew back from China, but they came back on the destroyer after the 8 months China duty after the war. And they came through the area that they were bombed with the atomic bomb that we did to see what was going to do to the fleet. So they came through there and actually dropped anchor in there and stayed there for several days, I guess. And all this war ships were still active, you know, radioactive and water must have been too. They were using water there and desalt it and stuff, but it sure as heck had to have something to do with it. But so then anyway, one of my best buddies was a pointer on the guns, and he said that they were allowed to go on them ships and take parts, pieces of them. And of course, a whole bunch of them got cancer and stuff from this, and he did too. But he said I was the best damn gunner on the ship. I was always bugging him about something, of course, but he was the pointer of my guns, yeah, yeah. So that was the one thing I could never understand, why they would do that. Because they were just as radioactive, I guess, as anything could be. Yeah. I don't know if they're still floating out there or not, but they might be.
Did you bring some things home?
Well, not from there, but I did from China, from North Africa. I brought a hand grenade back that I got in the German ammunition dump and bayonets, but you know what? The customs in New York took them away from me. So no, I didn't get home much of anything but except memories and, yeah.
What was life like after the war, after you got back and were discharged?
Well, I got married and the wife had a little boy. That was the reason I had to come home. But anyway, I could tell my story too, I guess, but she was pregnant, of course. Went up to Reno and get married. And I suppose the guys are still laughing about that because that damn sailor there with his pregnant woman, you know what happened. But I can stand that too, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But she passed away when the boy was about 9 years old from cancer. It was a little tough going, I guess.
I can imagine. What kind of jobs did you do?
Well, I got into construction. And I joined the Carpenters Union in 1950. 62. And I still belong to Carpenters Union. I'm after 57 years, I guess, 55 years. And which has been a wonderful thing for me, because my wife and I get our drugs, and I got a pension for 26 years that I've been, and stuff like this. And she can always kind of kid me about telling me she married me for my insurance, but it's not true. but it's been a wonderful thing. So I am a Democrat, of course. And I would say this much: the Republicans are a death stand against the union, and still are. So I remarried. It was a mistake. And then in 1980, well, I bought a little grape ranch in California. In 1980, I sold it. It was subdivision property. I sold it and came back here. And my cousin Norman was married to Betty, and he had passed away in 79. And so I came back in 80 plus and thought that maybe we could stir something up. I told her, we dated together quite a bit. And I said, well, if we'd marry me, we'd go to Hawaii and get married in the Fern Grotto. And she did, and we did. Yeah. And it, as far as I know, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the best thing I ever did.
26 years ago.
How do you think your service in the military in World War II changed you, or maybe affected what you did afterward after you got home?
Well, I guess you kind of learned you want to get along, maybe with people, maybe and who you have to work with or for, and maybe to value my freedom. Like I guess we all did.
Are you able to keep in touch, or have you been able to keep in touch with people you served with?
Yes, this pointer I'm telling you about, he lives in Pennsylvania, is it? Yeah. And we communicate back and forth, and we've made several reunions together. And the last one was in San Diego this last September, I guess. And we did plan to go and had everything fixed to go, but I just didn't figure I could make it, so we did. But he did, and he... But he's been ailing too, and we have a lot of good times together. And then one of them, the powder man that was on the guns with me, that handled the powder cases, was, I guess, really one of my best buddies. And we, we did a lot of reunions together with him, and he knew wherever he was in this place, was in the south, of the Cracker Barrel restaurants, and then he was also Kentucky Colonel, and we had a lot of good times together. So yeah, we did, yeah. And he passed away about 8 years ago now, I guess. Left his widow, which we do communicate with occasionally, but it's not the same.